time for a Golf Today roundtable. We welcome Golf Digest senior writer Joel Beal and SiriusXM PGA Tour Radio's Taylor Zarza. Great to be with you both. Joel, I understand you're overseas in the UK right now. Obviously, the headliner will be Rory McIlroy. As someone who writes so eloquently as you do, when you think about Rory McIlroy, what he's been through and what he wants to do, how much is he top of mind as you look at both this week and next week at Troon?
I think definitely next week at Troon, just because this week, failure or not, is not the week Rory is judged by, right? No one has put themselves more on the line in the past couple of years to stand up for what they believe in is right, with really nothing to gain and everything to lose, than Rory. And so to see what happened at Pinehurst and to kind of see the way he was treated for his actions at the end, not trying to condone the quick exit or failing to stick around to congratulate Bryson DeChambeau, but it was a little, it was interesting to see the lack of grace extended his way. Now, how he responds to that, I think, will be interesting, but I also don't know if we're really going to gather much from the Scottish Open next week, just because whatever happens at the Renaissance Club, it doesn't negate what happened this year. He does have three wins this year. It also doesn't take away the pain from Pinehurst. Troon's the only place he can really kind of make good on what happened at Pinehurst, and I think that's where we're gonna get the true window of where he's at. Obviously, he's gonna attempt to speak to the media, it seems like, at some point this week. It will be interesting to see what he says, but try to gather much from his play, I think we can't extrapolate too much this week.
Taylor, there's so many great storylines as we head into Troon. Another one is the guy who beat McIlroy at Pinehurst, Bryson DeChambeau, who he's approached this game as perhaps the most rigorous problem solver in the game, whether it's his golf swing or his equipment. But links golf always seems to be the puzzle he hasn't solved yet. He did finish top 10 at St. Andrews a couple of years ago, a golf course that lends itself to his bludgeoning style of play. But otherwise, it's been a pretty mediocre run in terms of links golf for Bryson. Do you think he's able to solve the links golf puzzle? And what do you expect from him next week?
My expectations are higher than they've been with him in the past, Eamon, because of what we just saw at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. While I realized he won 4 years ago at Wingfoot, he was gouging out of the rough in order to do that. This time he was able to show off such an incredible short game out of sandy lies and out of a very firm and fast golf course. We didn't expect him to show that sort of precision and touch around the greens. The last time we were together, we were broadcasting right from where he hit the most famous shot of his life and got up and down to win that U.S. Open trophy. So my expectations are higher. We see a guy that's finished in the top 10 in all the major championships this year. He's proven that he is a complete player. In the past, I would have doubted his ability to play on a golf course like this, but I think he's shown in 2024 that he's up for the challenge in these sort of events. So I would expect him to be a factor next week at Troon. It's interesting because I think that if we made a list of those that we thought that would have a chance, we would talk about Rory. We would certainly start with Scottie Scheffler. We'd mention Xander Schauffele. It might take us a minute to get to Bryson DeChambeau. It shouldn't. He should be at the top of our list.
Joel, how about top of the list in terms of needle movers in the game? Because there was a time when Bryson was the needle mover when he was driving greens at Bay Hill or at Whistling Straits. And then the thought was that he kind of disappeared when he went to LIV Golf. With that second U.S. Open title at Pinehurst number two, has he become the straw that stirs the drink in professional golf, even if he does play for a different tour?
Absolutely, and it's not just Pinehurst. I think we saw, especially over the weekend in Valhalla, he is now the people's favorite. And as crazy as it is, if you were at Valhalla and if you're at Pinehurst, it's hard to say differently. It will be interesting to see how he does next week, but I do think Bryson, so much is made of the equipment, his pursuit of distance. It overlooks that this is a really talented player just on his own right, and the fact that he did what he did at Pinehurst, a place that really leaned in on creativity, I think there's this stigma that Bryson doesn't do well with volatility, and clearly links golf called for that type of that mindset. So the fact that though he was able to do that at Pinehurst, I would be surprised if he doesn't do well. But yeah, if you're looking kind of the rest of the guys, a person I think is also getting overlooked is Colin Morikawa, someone who's had really good form this year. Obviously a very recent Open winner. He's missed his past two cuts at the Open, but he's really going under the radar, and I think because of so many good names have played lately. But I'd actually put Morikawa just right behind Bryson and guys I expect to do well next week.
Another guy who's kind of underperforming of late, Taylor, John Rahm. I know he missed the U.S. Open with a foot injury, but it's been something of a lost year in the majors for Rahm. Do you think he feels a little bit of pressure to kind of prove to people next week that moving to LIV was not a bad move for his career, which is probably too early to make that kind of assessment anyway? But it really has been a disappointing year, certainly compared to last year for Rahm.
Yeah, I don't think that he likes all this kind of inside golf criticism that he's receiving. He doesn't seem to handle that well, at least in public settings. But I think for his own sake, he wants to go prove that he can win a claret jug and have a chance next week, more than what everybody else is saying. I think you're spot on, Eamon. I think it's been a lost year so far in 2024, and I do wonder if he has any second thoughts. He got hundreds of millions of dollars to go play on LIV, and I think that a lot of people probably would have made the same choice had they been presented what Rahm was reportedly offered. Yet it feels like he's disconnected from the most competitive events in the sport, and he was seen as competitive as anyone in it at the end of 2023. So I wonder where his head is as he approaches this event, because so far this year, at least in the major championships, it has been a lost season. And I would imagine that we will see him bark back a bit at the media, as he's done a few times so far this year, when we get on site with him at Troon next week.
Joel, what do you think? John Rahm surely hasn't forgotten how to play golf just because he put on a different golf shirt on the weekends. How much is it the change in the schedule? You know, missing Torrey Pines, missing Muirfield Village, places where he's performed so well, or is something else going on in your estimation?
Well, he's admitted, Butch, that he has missed some of his favorite tour stops. I do think he's had a better year than his those major weeks have shown. But that being said, he's also of the caliber of player that he's only judged of the four big tournaments. So the fact that he had the injury exit in Pinehurst, I mean, if he has another early exit next week, it won't be hard to see the parallel of a player who was at the top of his game just a year ago, only to be a shell of himself at the biggest events. After he joined a league, he said he'd never join. That might be unfair, but given how well Rahm has played, specifically at the majors, not even just last year, but throughout his career, he brings his best at the four best. So to have this type of year after such a big decision, a decision he said he'd never make, I think it is a fair criticism of Rahm.
One of those fascinating players to watch next week at Royal Troon. When we come back, a discussion about the Ryder Cup. Who should be the next United States captain? And does 59 still carry the weight that it always did in professional golf? That's next on our roundtable. Stay with us.
We're back in Golf Today and continuing our conversation with Joel Beal of Golf Digest, Taylor Zarzar of Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio. Joel, I want to run some numbers by you here. Davis Thompson wins the John Deere Classic at 28 under. Scottie Scheffler won the Travelers 22 under. Cam Davis was lagging by comparison. He won in Detroit, the Rocket Mortgage, at 18 under. Two of those 3 weeks also saw 59 shot on the PGA Tour. A, does the 59 carry the weight that it used to carry as a symbol of excellence in this game? And B, do the fans deserve something better or more interesting than just a 25 under birdie shootout every week?
Well, on the first point, I don't think the 59 carries the same weight. I think there have been, 14 sub-60 rounds in PGA Tour history, and eight of those have happened in the past 8 years. That's not counting Bryson's 58 in West Virginia a year ago. Looking at this past week, Deer Run, that was a course designed specifically for tour players not that long ago, and it's already hilariously outdated. And if you're looking for why, I think Jordan Spieth partially gave us the answer earlier in the week when he talked about it's not just the ball that's going far, it's that you can have the miss hit that goes just as far as a hit right on the center. Clearly, distance is an issue, but I think the same sentiment goes for irons and even to an extent the wedges as well. We rarely see anything more than an 8-iron in these guys' hands on the approach. The 3 through 6 irons have become borderline extinct. I think there's also something you said for how the courses have been set up. The tour doesn't want to upset its membership, I think they acquiesce to presenting a test that's more scoreable than demanding. Really, only the Memorial gets away with presenting a tough test on an annual basis, and even then, you still hear players grumble about what Jack puts them through. So to answer your second point, I think it's a shame because I think this is unintentionally hurting the tour product. I think the easier the conditions are, the harder it is to decipher a good performance from a great performance. I think if the tour wants to have its best players in the mix more, or to just identify the best golfers on a more routine basis, I think the tougher setups are the answer to it.
Taylor, what do you think? Don't we should just tip our cap to the greatness of the players? This is the third time there have been multiple sub-60 rounds in the same season. 2010, it was Paul Goitis and Stuart Appleby. 2017, it was Justin Thomas. And 9 days later, it was Adam Hadwin. And now we have Springer and Young. How much is it just kind of players dragging off each other, all out the Roger Bannister breaking the four-minute mile?
I think there's some of that. And I was reading the bottom line on Golf Channel today that the fourth ever 59 was 14 years ago today by what you just referenced, Paul Goitis. We've had 10 of them, Damon, in the last 14 years. So we've had a bunch of them that have all been happening. And obviously we've had a couple in the last few weeks with Springer doing it this past weekend and Cameron Young doing it the weekend before. Now, I will say, if it's ball in hand and or it's dry or it's wet, soft conditions, I don't know that I would put an asterisk next to it, but it certainly isn't as challenging to do it as it is, say, in tougher conditions where you are not having the ball in your hand and it's dry, firm, and fast. But nevertheless, none of this bothers me. We should be all for bringing more of the casual fans into the game. And if they want to see a bunch of birdies happen each and every week, then so be it. You know, ideally, the purists that are on this screen right now may want to see less birdies. Mr. Doom and Gloom, Eamon Lynch, who's going to...
I want them all to play like me, Taylor.
Who's going to his Doom and Gloom paradise next week to Europe where the sun never shines. You know, look, that's fine. But I think that we need to capture the casual fan as much as we can. And if that means we have to see a bunch of birdies and see 25 under win, quote unquote, regular PGA Tour events, so be it.
Well, nothing seems to attract fans like the Ryder Cup. The United States expected to announce its captain tomorrow. We'll carry it live on Golf Channel. Joel, what would you like to see? A captain that kind of has been in the club, as it were, been an assistant captain? Or do you want to see the United States kind of think outside the box and bring in an unexpected voice?
Yeah, certainly the latter. I think the task force from 10 years ago has become the very thing it was trying to combat. And it was abundantly clear that the U.S. needs a wake-up call after that drubbing in Rome. I know there's no game plan that guarantees success, but if you're selling that this U.S. team will be different to fans, I think you need to have an avatar for the emotions that they have for the Ryder Cup that, optically at least, the American players have lacked. So I think in that same breath, the PGA of America, they're aware of the criticism that you just touched upon, that it's become a good old boys club. I mean, a great way to combat that stigma is to bring in someone from the outside who doesn't know the secret password to the club. It will be interesting to see the pick tomorrow. I mean, if you're talking outside the box, I'm pulling for Michael Block. I think that'd really be a real concern, but other than that, we'll see who the call is.
Taylor, are you on the same page as Joel here that
yes,
there's a need to kind of break up this, at least the perception of a boys club where they've been crowdsourcing the captaincy over the last decade?
Yeah, I think there needs to be more creativity with this pick. Look, if Tiger Woods accepts the position, then that's one thing. He absolutely deserves to have the first crack at this. And if he doesn't want to do it, then I do think they need to be rather creative with who the selection is, which we will all find out tomorrow. I'm of the opinion that they should go that route, that would be a better choice even than Tiger Woods for this Ryder Cup. And I think Tiger probably agrees with that. I think that Tiger would prefer to be the Ryder Cup captain at Adair Manor upcoming in 3 years, where there's not as much of the spotlight, some more of a remote location, and he doesn't have to worry about all the publicity that comes with New York in that market. And if that's the case, then yes, be creative with the selection. And I think Joel said it perfectly there with having an outside-the-box sort of selection. I think that if that's the case, then all 12 of the people that are playing on the team are, I don't want to say walking on eggshells, but they have the they realize they're not the captain and that they can't influence the captain and that the person that's calling the shots will be respected. And I just don't know that there was enough of that. Going into it, I thought Zach Johnson would do a great job in Italy. It didn't work out, and maybe some of those relationships that he had going into it were part of the reason why. But I would fully support the PGA of America if they were creative with this pick.
Can't wait to see what turns out to be the official call tomorrow. Since we're in Scottish season, guys, quick last question for you. What is the most fun golf course in Scotland? Taylor?
Ooh. Ah, man, what a good question. I'm going to go North Berwick. That's the most fun course I've played over there. There's some like Mirfield or the Old Course that may garner some more attention, but North Berwick's the most fun golf course I've played over in Scotland.
Joel?
For me, my heart's at Brora. It's if you're gonna make the trip to Dornick, it's a little spot that has just a lot of charm. Very open, even for you, Eamon. It's just a lot of fun. I think it really kind of gets back to the spirit and soul of the game, and it's just a lot of good fun.
The correct answer actually is Cruden Bay. I'm surprised neither of you brought it up, but it's very funky and quirky. But it's the essence, in my opinion, of Lynx Golf. Eamon, you can't
go with that. Are you taking us there?
Yeah, I'll take you there. I know some people at Cruden Bay. Eamon, what's your call?
I'm with Taylor on this one. I'd play the last six holes at North Berwick in a loop for the rest of my life and never be bored. They just need to kind of widen those fairways a little bit.
No doubt. Yeah. It is Lynx Golf season. Can't wait for Royal Troon next week. Taylor, Joel, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for the time.
We're back on Golf Today. It's time for an architect spotlight as we focus on one of the busier guys in the sport, Bo Welling. He's actually a busier guy in two sports, as we'll explain. You'll know most of his work from the Omni PGA Frisco, which is north of Dallas, Texas, the headquarters now of the PGA of America, renovating Ocean Forest as well, and a senior design consultant with TGR Design helping Tiger create Payne's Valley at Big Cedar Lodge and Blue Jack National outside of Houston.
A few more notable projects: Atlanta Country Club, Greenwich Country Club, not too far from our home at NBC Sports in Stamford, Pelican Golf Club, PGA Frisco, as Eamon mentioned, Stamford Golf Course as well. Now, get this. In addition to his role as an architect on his own projects and his work as the lead design consultant for Tiger's TGR Designs, Bo Welling also happens to be the president of the World Curling Federation, the WCF. He is currently in his second year as president, and great to have Bo Welling with us right now. In an article in Golf Digest, Bo, you called yourself the Forrest Gump of curling. What did you mean?
Well, as a boy that grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, there are not many people that are, dreaming of becoming involved in the Winter Olympic sport of curling. But I got bitten by the bug watching on television, and the more I learned about curling, the more fascinated I got. And that ultimately led me to go see it firsthand in a place called Bemidji, Minnesota, at the U.S. National Championships. And from there, this sort of crazy story starts happening where I keep meeting more and more people throughout the curling ecosystem, and ultimately got involved on the board of USA Curling, ultimately helped change how things kind of worked at USA Curling, and ended up getting involved with the World Curling, ended up going to, Vancouver Winter Olympics, Sochi Winter Olympics, Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, and then ultimately ended up on the board of World Curling, and then 2 years ago was elected to the president of the International Federation that supports curling for the Olympics. So it feels like a Forrest S. Gump sort of story. Bouncing my way through curling.
See, this is a warning to you, Bo. Whenever you start volunteering and doing stuff, they ask you to do even more.
I learned that.
I just tried curling when I was in Montreal a couple of months ago, and you won't be surprised to know it's yet another sport I have no coordination for at all. But the gentleman who was instructing my group that day did say that there is a golf connection, one that's pretty close to Royal Troon, where the Open is next week.
Yeah, that's true. So I like to say that, both golf and curling are both ancient Scottish sports. They both started in Scotland about the same time. And curling really started in northern Scotland, where it was too cold to play golf in the winter. They started throwing stones on frozen fens, frozen ponds. But all curling stones come from Ailsa Craig, which is that big rock, the big island that you see off the coast of Troon. I'm sure it'll be in many, many shots over the weekend. But all that granite there is some of the hardest rock on the planet Earth. And so we quarry from that rock once a year, and Kays of Scotland is the longtime vendor, maker of curling stones. But all the raw material comes from those images that you're showing right now. So it's pretty unique. And when you play Troon, you play Prestwick, you play Turnberry, you look out and you see Ailsa Craig, and it almost looks like a curling stone. But it's a really special place, and it's very much part of the fabric of the sport of curling.
It does look like a curling stone, or perhaps the head of the Kraken, if you're into Greek mythology. Any other links between golf and curling in terms of the endeavor themselves, maybe the touch required with the broom and the stone, and maybe compare it to a 60-degree wedge?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, they're both ancient Scottish sports, but angles are important in both sports. They both have sort of weird terminology and jargon. They're both sports based on values and integrity. You call your own fouls in both sports, and they're both camaraderie based. And I would even argue that both are sort of excuses maybe to have a drink of scotch or whatnot. But it's really been interesting to start. I started the Palmetto Curling Club in Greenville, South Carolina. One of those pictures was the inception of the Palmetto Curling Club. And what's been interesting to see is getting people on ice who had never been on ice before. But if they have a golf background, they pick it up radically faster. And I think it's because it's sort of like team putting. So you read the ice conditions are going to change as the rock goes down the surface of ice. It'll curve or curl, you know, sometimes 4 to 8 feet laterally. So there's this real precision to all of that. And where it differs from golf is you have a putt, let's say in golf, that is going to break. And as soon as you hit it, you've known you've not hit it with enough pace for the line you've chosen. In curling, you can scream at your teammates to sweep, and they can go affect the trajectory of that stone, and in essence, keep that stone or ball online. So it's really a team effort to get the stones in position, you know, some 50 yards away from where the stone is released.
Who complains more, Bo? Is it golfers about the golf course, or is it curlers about the rink?
It's very, very similar. So when you'll notice that when a golfer is complaining, I always say, well, go check their score. And the same sort of true with curling. So if a curling person is complaining about ice, they tend to have a few more losses in the column than wins. So I think this is that'd be another commonality between golf and curling.
I got one more potentially, Bo. I read that there are golf clubs that double as curling clubs in the winter. Any famous examples of that?
Yeah, I mean, so the origin of the sport really in the Northern Hemisphere, I mean, in our hemisphere, you know, in the Americas, was really, they dovetail together, especially in cold weather places. So lots of golf and curling clubs in Canada. But here in the United States, probably the most famous would be the Country Club. So the Country Club still has an active curling operation there in Brookline. So obviously world-class golf, but also has world-class curling.
Let's move on to grass from ice for a moment. But what are you working on these days in terms of your golf course design business?
Well, I mean, we've got a lot going on. So, and it's great. And I keep telling my younger guys that this is the most exciting time in my 28-year career because so much is going on. So we've just broken ground on a couple of big new 18-hole golf courses in Texas. So a place called the Travis Club outside of Austin, a place called Freestone just south of Dallas. We actually have a project under construction in Scotland, a place called Taymouth Castle. So there's some James Braid history there. So that's been sort of super exciting to kind of work on that. Finishing up some big renovations. They wanted Lake Norman in Charlotte, North Carolina, a place called the Peninsula Club. About to start in my home course, Greenville Country Club, a place called Chanticleer. So it's where I grew up playing golf. So it's either going to be the funnest project I've ever done or singly the stupidest attempt at anything I've ever tried to do, but I'm excited about it. And then we are continuing to help TGR. So we got a great project going with Mike Trout in Southern New Jersey. Just started working really hard on something in Park City, Utah called Marcella and a second golf course in Cabo at Diamante. So the airlines like me right now because I seem to be paying them lots of money to get around to all these places. But it's super, super exciting.
Bo, even with the unknowns in the professional game, are you still seeing and hearing anecdotally that people are playing golf and flocking to golf courses and wanting to learn the games? What are you hearing and seeing on the ground?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm a data guy, so I'm always kind of looking at the data. And I think this COVID effect remains very prevalent and sticky. I think we as an industry have started to realize that we need to make golf, you know, much more accessible to bring new people in. And I think the industry's macro doing a very good job of that. I think this rise of the short course and all these putting experiences are great sort of ways to onboard people. I think the other big thing kind of I see going on is the lapsed golfer has really come back. You know, COVID helped them find golf again. It happens every week. I'll run into somebody, they'll say, you know, I stopped playing golf because life got in the way. And then during COVID, I started playing again. And now I'm back playing two, three times a week. So I think all that's great. And then, you know, the population's kind of moving around and, you know, where people are moving into, there's lots of golf development. So hence why, you know, we're working hard in Texas. And, you know, we've got forgot a renovation in Florida. And I'm in Georgia looking at something new right now and Carolinas. And so in Mountain West. So it's all great. And, you know, another project I forgot to mention is we're working in Stowe, Vermont, in a historic Stowe Country Club. And, you know, to see even Stowe, like, has really sort of exploded in terms of the amount of people that are coming up there and wanting to be in such a great, incredible environment. Golf's a big part of that, too. So it's a super exciting time. And I think it's going to stay that way.
Well, Bo, I'm going to be checking out your work at Teignmouth Castle in Scotland in a couple of weeks. So if the fairways aren't wide enough, you can expect to hear from me. Appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thanks, guys. Y'all have a great day. Appreciate it.
And you, Bo Welling. All right, folks, we're counting down the days until the 152nd Open at Royal Troon. Coming up next, we're catching up with Elvis Smiley, who will make his Open debut after advancing from final qualifying. Wait till you hear his backstory and family connection. That's next.
Elvis Smiley joins us now. Elvis, congratulations on your play last week. You put yourself in great position with a 67 in the first round. What were the nerves like going into the second round when you knew you'd actually put yourself on the brink of a spot in the Open?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Going back to last Tuesday, the 36-hole shootout at Royal St. Port's, the morning round I played really well. I got off to a really good start. I had 5 under. Conditions were pretty good. I felt like it was scorable. And then, yeah, heading in the afternoon, conditions actually started to pick up a bit, and I felt like having that 5 under in the first round really gave me a bit of a leg up. And I shot 2 over in the afternoon round, but I'm stoked to get through, and I can't wait for Troon next week.
And you'll be going to a place where you've been before. Back in 2016, you were 14 years of age. I understand you were a spectator at Royal Troon for the Open Championship. What do you remember?
Yeah, so the first time I've experienced a major championship, I was 14 years old, and that was 8 years ago at Royal Troon. So I was with my mum and dad, and I still remember watching Henrik Stenson and Phil Mickelson jostle it out coming down the stretch. And I remember some things of Troon, but I'm definitely going to have to freshen up the memory by the time next week comes around. But right now I'm in Edinburgh, actually. It's nice and sunny outside, so it reminds me of home. So I'm using this week as a training week before I head to Troon on Sunday, and I'll walk the course on Sunday and then get into the swing of things from Monday onwards.
What did you learn in last year's qualifier? You also played it at St. Port's last year, I believe. What did you learn last year that helped you this time around, Elvis?
I think it's just the experience side of things. I think the more times you put yourself in situations like that, the better you'll handle it. You definitely know that there's a lot on the line that day. And I think the mindset that I had going into last Tuesday compared to the year before was I just went out and just let it happen. I didn't really play, when I say this, I didn't play with much care, even though that sounds a bit bizarre. I kind of just let it happen in a way. And I think I took the pressure off myself by having that kind of mindset, because like I said, everyone knows what's at stake with days like that. But I felt like I just handled myself really well. I took each shot as it came. And I had a 20-year-old caddy who's actually a college golfer in America, and he's a member at Royal St. Port's. And we just chatted a lot of rubbish, a lot of nonsense. And I felt like it really helped me switch off in times where it definitely got a bit tense. So I think just having the right person by your side is extremely important in days like that as well.
Elvis, I found that children of professional athletes, they either gravitate to sports or run as far away from it as humanly possible. We're both tennis nerds. Your mom, a four-time Grand Slam champ. How much have you leaned on her just in terms of the ins and outs of being a professional and quieting the mind inside the ropes?
Yeah, I think I'm very fortunate to have, my mom obviously being one of the best tennis players in the world back in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And then my dad was also a top 200 tennis player in the world. So I feel like in terms of advice, they can relate a lot, because they, both of them, went through what I'm going through, but in a different sport. But a lot of the characteristics are the same in terms of your work ethic and doing the 1% stuff. And I remember after I finished on Tuesday, I headed straight to Wimbledon to stay with my mum for a couple of nights while she's working for the BBC for the 2 weeks commentating. And she just said, "You're in this position for a reason. You've worked your absolute backside off to be in this position. You deserve it. And go out next week and showcase the world what you're capable of." So I think the result on Tuesday was just a byproduct of all the great work that I've been doing. I've made quite a few adjustments with my team and the people I've got around me, and I feel like I'm working towards something really special, and I hope I can showcase that next week at Troon.
Elvis, your godfather is Tony Roach, another Australian tennis legend, and a little bird tells me that you once sort of ran out of a hotel elevator towards Tony Roach, and it led to a pretty funny moment.
Yeah, so Roach is my godfather, and his daughter, Jackie, was getting married. Gosh, this is going back so far, but I'll try and remember it. It was in Sydney. We were staying at a hotel, and a really good friend of mine and myself, we were, you know, maybe like 9, 10. And we got into the elevator of the hotel that we were staying at. And, you know, knowing me when I was 9, 10, I didn't really listen to my mom and dad too much. So I jumped in the elevator with my mate, and we ended up just going up to like the 6th, 7th floor because the pool was like a rooftop bar. Anyway, long story short, I walk in and Priscilla is in the elevator. And at the time, I didn't know who Priscilla was. And anyway, so I end up going up in the elevator. My mom's on the ground floor, and she yells out, and I can hear her. She's like, "Elvis, you better get down here right this second, or else there's no swim." And, you know, obviously I didn't listen at all, and I kept going. But Priscilla at the time must have thought, like, Elvis was, you know, long gone as well, like Presley. She must have thought that, you know, you're talking to, like, Elvis Presley, like her dead husband. And it was just the most bizarre thing. And I always get told that story as well. But, yeah, it's pretty funny. I mean, I'd hate to know what Priscilla was thinking. She probably hates my mum's guts, but that's okay.
Well, Damon actually has his big match tonight. He's in the B flight of his club tennis championship. Are there any tips you'd like to give him before he goes?
Tennis? Oh, gosh. I mean, I haven't played in so long, but... you're probably asking the wrong person. I can text my mum quick and just see if she can give you some pointers. But
please, he needs everything he's got.
I'm not shy to take tips, especially from a four-time Grand Slam champ. Elvis, listen, it's been so great talking to you. You've earned that spot next week. Can't wait to meet you at Royal Troon, and thanks for hopping on with us.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
We're back on golf today. The last time the Korn Ferry Tour was in action a couple of weeks ago, Max McGreevy came up clutch on the 72nd hole of the Memorial Health Championship to win his second Korn Ferry Tour title. Not only did Max take home the trophy, he locked up his 2025 PGA Tour card. Now, Max's win 2 weeks ago came in Springfield, Illinois. It just so happens his first win on the Korn Ferry Tour came in Springfield, Missouri at the 2020 Price Cutter Charity Championship. So, fair to say, Max is the king of Springfields. And great to have Max McGreevy with us now. And speaking of that first win, in that win, you had to sit around and wait. A couple of weeks ago, you clutched up and birdied the 18th hole. How would you describe the differences in the feeling between those two wins?
Yeah, definitely still a lot of nerves and whatnot with both of them. But that first one was definitely stressful, having to wait around. Actually being able to do it myself this last week was kind of a dream come true. Unfortunately, made bogey on 17 to put myself in that situation, but that's kind of what we all hope and dream to have, is a putt like that to win a tournament. And to be honest, thinking back, I don't know if I've really ever done anything like that before, birdieing the 18th hole like that. So just super rewarding to be able to finish it off like that and be able to give that reaction.
Now, Max, after you stumbled on 17 with a bogey, you had a pretty unique way of relaxing yourself and refocusing yourself on the 18th tee before you teed off.
Yeah, you know, I've had a picture of my wife and our little dog in my yardage book for probably about a year now or so. And once we're expecting a little girl now at the end of the year, and once we have the ultrasound, I was able to get a picture of it and put it also in my yardage book. So, you know, just being able to think back to them and, you know, knowing regardless of what happened, I was going to go home and be able to see them, and they were going to love on me. Just little things like that just make those moments a little bit easier for me, and was happy I was able to think about it at the time to take a look at them and take a deep breath and get back to it.
Yeah, and what ways did that action allow you to kind of forget about what you were trying to do and disengage and relax and be able to breathe a little bit differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think I forgot about the nerves that I just had on 17 missing a 5-6 foot putt, you know? You know, it's all we're trying to do out here is trying to not think about the bad things that have happened. And, you know, when you're standing up on 18 bucks, it could be easy to think about the nerves that you just had on the last green. So it was just able to give me a couple deep breaths, take a couple looks at a couple people that I know just love me and care about me so much. And I just think that eased my mind so much in that moment and just gave me a lot more confidence and clarity going into the last hole.
You're headed back to the PGA Tour, Max. You've been out there before for a couple of seasons. How are you a different or better player heading back to the tour now than you were the last time?
I just really think I've learned a lot in this, you know, 6-7 months we've played now on the Korn Ferry Tour compared to last year. I just really took this year as a learning curve. And, you know, unfortunately, I did lose my PGA Tour card, but hopefully it ended up being the best thing to happen for me as far as just learning from my mistakes, learning from what I needed to get better at, and just gaining some confidence in ways that I haven't had in the last 2 years. So, you know, I think I'm so much more confident in my game now, even than when I got my PGA Tour card for the first time. And I just, you know, again, we all talk about belonging and feeling like we need to belong. And I did at times on the PGA Tour, but I think for sure now I know that my game matches up to those guys. And I'm just happy to bring it back and play some good golf again out there on the PGA Tour.
So much change in terms of the PGA Tour, even in a couple of years since you were last there. There's obviously more change to come. And there has been some grumbling this year that guys graduating from the Korn Ferry Tour haven't had perhaps as many opportunities through the first half of the year as they've had in the past. Is that a sentiment that you think exists among your fellow players on the Korn Ferry Tour, that there's a little bit of concern of exactly how often they're going to get to use this tour card that they're earning?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, you know, unfortunately, if you don't get off to a good start from us guys from the Korn Ferry Tour, you know, you've got five opposite field events compared to, you know, some of the bigger events or elevated fields and stuff. So it is a little bit worrisome, I would say, at times, but you know, unfortunately, golf is golf, and you got to play good to make it to the next ranks and make it up the totem pole as you kind of go on. So, you know, as much as we can worry about those type of things, you know, you just have to be ready to go and be ready to win. And, you know, I think that's what I'm going to be ready for next year and hopefully get off to a good start.
Max, before you were an expectant father, I understand you were a roommate of Scottie Scheffler back in 2019, 2020. In Dallas, what was he like? Did he make his bed, clean up the room, take out the trash? You know, what kind of roommate was the world number one?
Yeah, Scotty was a pretty good roommate. He definitely was a little messy at times. I would, from what I've seen now since him and Meredith have gotten married, he's definitely cleaned up probably the room and everything else a little bit more, and with little Bennett there too. But no, he was a great roommate. He was a great cook. He loved you know, getting on the green egg and firing up, you know, whatever meats he had bought at the grocery store for all of us to cook and be together. And, you know, it was a ton of fun. I think we had four professional golfers in the house at the time, and you're just kind of feeding ideas off each other, trying to figure out how to get better. And, you know, unfortunately, Scotty is a year younger than me, so I hated that, you know, he had so much knowledge at an early age compared to myself. But, you know, I just loved gaining knowledge from him, all that type of stuff. And no, he was a great roommate. Excited to hopefully play some more practice rounds with him this next year.
You've played a lot already this year, Max, and logged a lot of miles in pursuit of your dream this year. Is the travel the toughest part of the grind for you over the last couple of years, when you have to put in so many hours in so many far-flung places to get back to where you were?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the toughest part. I mean, I'm definitely not a spring chicken now. This is my seventh year, I think, playing professional golf. So I'm 29. I definitely still feel like I'm 23, but you know, you play 28 to 33 events a year. It's just going to wear on your body. So even a day like today, I'm flying over to Denver tomorrow to play the Korn Ferry event, but I'm trying to make the weeks as short as possible and be prepared back home here. So once I get, you know, to an event or something like that, I'm more prepared, and I'm not putting in the long hours, you know, once you get to the event type of thing. So I'm learning as I go, as far as that goes, but I think I'm getting better at that. And and just enjoying the ride, enjoying, you know, all the different weeks that we have on the road, but trying to make it as easy some as it can be.
and still working on your game in Edmond, Oklahoma at Oak Tree. I can see that the trees behind you are moving, and no surprise that it's windy in Oklahoma. Max, we appreciate the time, and best of luck in 2025 on the PGA Tour.
Thank you guys so much.
Well, the Pure Insurance at Pebble Beach never disappoints. It brings together Champions Tour veterans and kids from first tee programs around the country. Today, we've been announcing which kids will make it there this year, and after the break, we're going to talk to a tour veteran and the first tee participant he inspired.
Now, Morgan Riley is a member of First Tee Triangle in North Carolina. He finished tied for fifth with a score of minus 19 at the 2023 Pure Insurance Championship, playing in a junior pro team with Tim O'Neill. He will graduate from high school in 2025. And please be joined now by Tim O'Neill and Morgan Riley. Great to see you guys. Morgan, let's go back to last year. What do you remember about the surprise, first of all? What was the experience like playing alongside Tim O'Neill at Pebble?
The experience was great. Couldn't ask for, you know, a much better experience from the staff. The course, obviously, we got to play was great. And then, obviously, playing alongside Tim O'Neill for 318 holes was, I mean, amazing. Kind of get to learn another perspective from a junior to a pro. Kind of see what it's like and what it takes.
Tim, this is a pretty unique format on the Champions Tour, playing with first tee kids. Do you find as though you approach that week differently than you would on any other given week of the year where you kind of have to be in your one-man zone?
Yeah, for me, it's I feel like it's a little bit more relaxing. You're out there playing with the first tee guys, you know, the kids and the girls, and, you know, you just want them to have a good experience, so you kind of forget about your game and you kind of just kind of have fun with the kids.
You know, Tim, first tee produces not just great players, but maybe more importantly, great people. What do you think of Morgan's game, and what do you think of him as a person as well?
Oh, great kid. Has tons of game. I know his brother, Quinn, really good guy as well. Their parents have done a great job with both of them. But Quinn's game is really strong. He hits it a ton. You know, everything about his game is really good. He's only going to get better.
Morgan, Tim mentioned your older brother, Quinn, who also played in the Pure Insurance at Pebble Beach. Which of you guys ended up with bragging rights?
I'm not sure. The only thing I can really say is, you know, I went when he did it back then and had a great experience. But when I got to go for myself, it kind of really changed things. And, you know, you got to kind of be in the driver's seat. So, I mean, I felt like I played pretty good. So, can't really remember what, you know, how he did, but I might have bragging rights on that one.
What was more?
Oh, he's being modest. He played really good.
What was more important on a week like that, Morgan? Was it the experience or was it the performance? What's your mindset going into a week like that?
For me, I think it was really just, you know, obviously Tim's still playing an event, so for me it was, you know, honestly rip driver on every hole and just have a good time, you know, taking the views while you can. But at the same time, you know, still try and, you know, get aggressive on the course. And I think that kind of worked out. You know, I could easily rip driver while, you know, he's kind of playing out the course like he really should. So it made it easy for me, made it really enjoyable and, you know, made it easy to card a pretty good number.
Morgan, you hail from the First Tee Triangle program in North Carolina. The CEO, Brandon Baker, is a buddy of mine. What has that program given you and meant in your life?
Yeah, so I'd say, you know, obviously golf has been a big part of my life since I was, you know, 3 years old. And so, you know, First Tee kind of had that, you know, space and area for a golfer like me to kind of really grow and connect, you know, golf into my, you know, personal life. Which was huge for me in kind of finding who I am as a person and who I am as a golfer.
Tim, what would you say to either kids or parents who are out there who don't necessarily know a lot about the First Tee program or the kind of opportunities like this it can provide? What would your message be to folks like that?
Well, I mean, if you have a kid that's just trying to play golf, the First Tee is a great place for a kid to learn how to play golf and learn the core values And then, you know, kids can just grow from there and then, you know, get experiences like playing Pebble Beach. And, you know, it can definitely life lessons that they can learn as an adult as well.
Tim, you're a mentor. You're also a player. This week, a major in Akron on PGA Tour champion. State of your game, excitement level going into one of the meatiest, most difficult golf courses at Firestone.
Yes. I was here last year. I love the golf course. It's a very challenging golf course. It puts a premium on driving, and having some length definitely helps. But I'm looking forward to this week. I've been trending in the right direction, so hopefully I can keep it going and have a good week this week, but I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Morgan, do you have any advice to give to Tim this week when he's heading out to play in a major?
You know, I guess play good. That's all I really get from my kind of perspective over here. I guess hit fairways and keep it in play.
That's it. Fairways work anywhere.
Exactly.
Especially, though, at Firestone. Tim, best of luck this week. And Morgan and Tim, best of luck this fall. Looking forward to seeing you guys compete once again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.